So we want to continue in volume 8 with September the 2nd, 1908, and we're talking about virtue, okay? So I want to give you 1 John 4:16 to start you off. 1 John 4:16. I'm going through bitter days because of the continuous privations of blessed Jesus. He came for just a little and he told me, "My daughter, the way you can know whether one has charity is that he loves the poor." That's not a test we would have given ourselves as to how would you know you loved somebody. In fact, if the person loves the rich and is available to them, he may do so because he hopes to obtain something. So I want you to write beside that at the letter of St. James, and it's chapter 5. And he gives terrible warnings to the rich. Now, I think he may be also saying something about it in chapter 4. And he brings up the subject. In fact, he may bring it up in chapter 1, that the church makes a difference between the rich and the poor. The rich are welcomed and the poor aren't. That is in an assembly. Okay, this is exactly what Jesus is going to say here. So that's the letter of James. In fact, if he loves the rich and is available for them, he may do so because he hopes for something or he will obtain something. And because he's in sympathy with them or because of their nobility, their intelligence, their eloquence, or even out of fear. But if he loves the poor and helps them and supports them, it's because he sees in them the image of God. Image of God, Genesis 1, 27 and Genesis 2, 7. Therefore, he does not look at roughness, ignorance, rudeness, or misery. Through those miseries, as though through a glass, he sees God. 2 Corinthians 9, 6 to 9. He sees God, from whom he hopes to obtain everything. So he loves them, he helps them, he consoles them as if he were doing it for God himself. That's Matthew 25, 40. What you do to the least of my brethren, you do to me. Do you remember? This is the good thing about true virtue, which begins from God and ends in God. So the origin of something will tell you whether it's good or bad. On the other hand, that which begins from matter, that's earthly stuff, produces matter and ends in matter. I want to give you Matthew 6, 24. They've had their reward. So as bright and virtuous as charity may appear, if the divine touch is not felt, both in the one who does it and in the one who receives it, they become bothered, annoyed and tired. And if necessary, they will even commit defects. Isn't that interesting? In other words, there's no grace. September the 3rd, 1908, Jesus is the light. So this subject is light. And so what we're going to move on to is that Jesus is also going to say, "I am the light and I am the truth." OK, so for "I am the light" is John 8, 12 and John 9, 5. As Jesus said, "I am the light of the world." "God is light" is 1 John 1, 5. OK. So Louisa said, "As I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus made himself seen all light," 1 John 1, 5, "and said these simple words, 'I am light.' But what is light made of?" This is a very important thing. It's a question people don't think of asking. Yeah, okay, such a thing as light, but what's light made of? He said, "What is the principle of it?" He said, "It is truth." Isn't that fascinating? Mm-hmm. So that's John 14, 6. He said, "So I am light because I am truth." And in John 14, 6, he says, "I am the way, the truth and the life." Therefore, in order for the soul to be light and to have light, so that is Ephesians 5, 8, EPH, Ephesians 5, 8, and Galatians 2, 14. Just that the subjects of light and truth are huge in the New Testament. Ephesians 5:8 and Galatians 2:14. It's better to ask me. In order for the soul to be light and to have light in all her actions, these must come from truth, not from deceit or duplicity or falsehood or anything else. They must come from the truth. Wherever there is artifice, deception and duplicity, there cannot be light. It's only darkness. 2 Corinthians 6, 7. And I also want to give you Ephesians 6, 14. And you can go on and on and on. Where St. Paul says, beware of the angel of light. That's Satan disguising himself, deceiving you. So September the 5th, 1908, we're going to be talking about the divine presence. I was speaking with the confessor, Louisa said, and he was saying how terrible it will be to see God indignant. This is so true that on the day of judgment, the wicked will say, mountains, bury us, destroy us, that we may not see the face of God. That's Isaiah 2:10. It's a quotation. Isaiah 2:10 and Revelation 6:16. Now, in the Old Testament, their fear of God's judgment, they would run into caves and they'd try and get under mountains and they'd ask the mountains to protect them. In our day, they have built cities underground and they think that, you know, everybody else is killed up above, that they're going to survive underground. You should read Revelation 6:16. The Lord says, I'll find you wherever you are. And Louisa was saying, in God there cannot be indignation, but rather it is according to the state of the soul. If she is good, the divine presence, his qualities, his attributes attract her whole self within God. And that's Genesis 3:8. Genesis 3:8 and Psalm 16:11. Genesis 3:8, Psalm 16:11. So his attributes attract her whole self within God, and she is consumed with the desire to immerse herself completely in God. If she's bad, his presence crushes her, drives her away from him. And in seeing herself rejected and not feeling within her any seed of love towards a God so holy, so beautiful, while she is so ugly and bad, the soul would rather get rid of his presence, if possible, even by destroying herself. Now, there's loads of references. I'm going to give you a few. Psalm 17:2. Psalm 51:11. Psalm 68:2 and Genesis 4:16. Genesis 4 is Cain not able to take God's judgment on himself. Do you remember? So in God there is no mutation, but rather we experience different effects according to how we are. This is a very important point that she's making here, that we live our entire lives on this earth on a, if you look at me for a moment, if you draw a line and it has two ends on it, and one end it has mercy and the other end it has justice. So if you're tending to live a good life, you're living at the mercy end of the spectrum. If you're living a bad life, you're living at the justice end of the spectrum. Now, in case you think that that's unusual, a child grows up between the hugs and kisses of the parent and the discipline of the parent. And depending on the child's behaviour depends on which end of this a continuum they're actually at. Society is the same, that the people who live at the criminal end know all about the courts and all the rest of it, and people who are keeping the laws and living a good life, they may never see the inside of a court in the whole of their lives. So it's one spectrum and the two ends. So that's what Louisa is saying, that it depends on the way we're living as to which aspect of God we actually experience. So afterwards, Louisa said, I thought to myself, that's much nonsense that I said. And then while I was doing the meditation during the day, Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, it was well said. I do not change. But it is the creature that feels the different effects of my presence as she changes. So that's what we've just explained. In fact, how can one who loves me ever fear? That's Psalm 27, verses 1 and 2. Psalm 27, verses 1 and 2, and 1 John 4:18. Perfect love casts out fear. Okay. So how can one who loves me ever fear if she feels my whole being flow within her and form her very life? Can she ever fear my sanctity if she takes part in that sanctity herself? Can she ever be ashamed of my beauty if she keeps trying to embellish herself ever more in order to please me and to be like me? She feels the whole of the divine being, all of it, flow in her blood, in her hands, in her feet, in her heart, in her mind. Just as your whole soul occupies every single part of your body, so the Lord's presence will fill your entire being. Okay, that's why you can lay hands on somebody else and the Lord will heal them. There's nothing in my hands, but because the presence of the Lord is in me, he can touch your hands through me. Or he can speak a word of consolation through me. My words are no use to you. Okay? People don't realise that when they do the laying on of hands, what's actually going on. And they think some people have what they call healing hands. No, our hands are either dirty or clean. You know what I mean? No, it's the Lord's presence in that person reaching out to you. So there's the divine being flowing in all of her blood, her hands, her feet, her heart and her mind in such a way that it is something that belongs to her. It's fully her own. Now, for that, I want to give you Galatians 2:20. I no longer live. Christ lives in me. So if Christ is living in me, of course he can speak, he can see, he can hear, he can touch, can't he? If he's living in me. And how can it fear or be ashamed of itself? That is the presence of God in us. This is impossible. My daughter, it is sin that casts so much disorder into the soul. And she reaches a point of wanting to destroy herself so as not to bear my presence. I want to give you Matthew 25:31-46. They end up out of his presence forever. Do you remember? Because Matthew 25:31 is the judgment. On the judgment day, it will be terrible for the wicked. And this is the Lord speaking. Not seeing any seed of love in themselves, but rather hate towards me, my justice imposes on me to not love them. Isn't that scary? Mm. And the persons who are not loved, one does not want to keep them around. And one makes it some means to drive them away. I will not want to keep them with me, that is forever. And they won't want to stay, and they will even shun each other. Love alone is that which unites everything and makes everyone happy. So for love alone, I want to give you 1 Corinthians 14:1. You must want love more than anything else. Now, I want to give you a couple of scriptures for the persons who can't stand the presence of God and would prefer hell. Is that okay? Mm-hmm. Isaiah 35:8-10. Isaiah 35 is talking about the redeemed on the journey back to God. And they say nothing unclean will be on that road. That's Isaiah 35:8-10. Revelation 21:27. Which says that everybody living a foul life will not be permitted into the city of God. And that's that. And Revelation 22:15 as well says the same thing. Now, elsewhere in these writings, Jesus said that Louisa even witnessed it herself, that if Jesus visited purgatory, even came anywhere near it, the souls would automatically rush out to meet him. But when they would see his infinite purity and holiness, they would have to draw back. because they couldn't face that, and they would willingly go back to purgatory to get more cleansing. Okay, so it's a mutual thing. It's not just God saying, I don't want you around. It's us saying, you couldn't stay around. Yeah. So September the 6th, 1908, Jesus wanted to suffer in order to reunite everything in himself. Continuing my usual state, I was thinking about the mystery of the scourging. And as Jesus came, pressing his hand on my shoulders, I heard him say in my interior, my daughter, I wanted my flesh to be scattered in pieces. It certainly was. And my blood to be shed for the whole, from my whole humanity, so as to reunite all of dispersed humanity. Now, you know from the hours of the Passion that each one of those bits that fell off his body represented a soul that was lost. Okay. In fact, of all that was torn from my humanity, flesh, blood, hair, nothing was dispersed in my resurrection. He got everything back, didn't he?
Yeah.
But everything was reunited again to my humanity. By this, I incorporated all creatures within me. That's how it's so easy to pray for them. They're all in Christ. Okay. So after this, if one wanders from me, it is out of his own obstinate will. Therefore, you're completely responsible that he tears himself from me to go out and be lost. So September the 7th, 1908, is about self-abnegation. Okay. And we're told that the more you deprive yourself of on earth, the more you will have in heaven. But the vast majority of people I know would prefer as much as they can on earth. Okay. So the subject of this very important piece is austerity on earth, plenty in heaven. Austerity on earth, plenty in heaven. And that is the reasoning behind people going out into deserts to spend their lives in abject poverty and loneliness for the sake of the kingdom. The people going into monasteries and all the rest of it. So, and for this, I want to give you Luke chapter 9. Luke 9, verses 23 to 26. 23 to 26. And Matthew 16, verses 24 to 27. And Mark chapter 8, verses 34 to 38. Mark chapter 8, verses 34 to 38. Now, in Luke's gospel, there's an enormous amount of material on being poor on the earth and rich in heaven. And the whole of chapter 16 of Luke is about that. Also, there's chapter 12, you know. And Luke is the one who says over and over, you know, to give everything away. So Louisa said, as I was in my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, the more things of which the soul deprives herself down here is earth, the more she will have up there, which is heaven. I think it's fascinating to use that language, down here and up there. Okay. And the reason for that is that where we stand, to us, heaven is up there and earth is down here. So he's not revealing anything new about the universe. He's just simply talking about how it looks from where you stand. That's all. So the poorer on earth, he said, the richer in heaven. Now, that's Luke all over the place. The more she is deprived of tastes. Now, taste is used in these writings to mean satisfaction. Okay, so you better write in the word satisfaction there. The more she's deprived of satisfaction, pleasures, amusements, trips. Oh, boys. Our generation are addicted to trips, aren't they? Strolls. I'd hate to know what a stroll is, because to me that's going for a walk on the earth. The more satisfaction and pleasures she will have in God. Now, what you do is you take the principle there that if we live a life in which the self is being put in its place, and God is being put in his place, that's the balance that we have. Oh, how she will stroll in the expanse of the heavens. Now, why is she using stroll? I want to give you Genesis 3:8. Because God walked with Adam in the cool of the day. That's what you're told in Genesis 3:8. So she says, you'll be strolling in the expanse of the heavens. Now, one of the reasons why she's using that language is that elsewhere in these writings, Louisa will tell you that she is taken up into the heavens and that she goes strolling around the place with Jesus. It's fascinating. I don't know how you stroll in space, which apparently she did it. But then I don't know how you walk on water either. Oh, how she will stroll in the expanse of the heavens, especially in the immeasurable heavens. So that means the heavens above are the Milky Way. The immeasurable heavens are infinitely further than that. Okay. So the immeasurable heavens, God's home, of the attributes of God. In fact, each attribute is one more heaven, one more paradise among the blessed. Some enter into them as though at the margin. Okay, now before we move on there, just make sure you know what the attributes of God are. Mercy and justice and wisdom and sanctity and all the rest. And they're all equal. The whole lot of them are equal. So in heaven, they stroll around these aspects of God and they have absolutely infinite pleasure and satisfaction out of it. So now we talk about people who are entering heaven for the first time. Some people enter heaven through the margins of the attributes of God. In other words, the relationship isn't all that wonderful. And so they've all their learning to do in heaven. Some walk in the middle of them, so they've done a bit of work on earth, okay? And some even higher. I hope to goodness we're a little bit higher. And the more they walk, the more they taste, enjoy, and delight there. So one who leaves the earth takes heaven, be it even in the smallest thing. Therefore, it follows that the more one is despised, the more one is honoured. The smaller, the greater. The more submitted, the more dominant, and all the rest. Yet of the mortals, who thinks of depriving himself of something on the earth to have it eternally in heaven? Almost no one. Would you ever colour that? That's the revelation. In other words, they mightn't even arrive at the margins. Do you know what I mean? So October the 3rd, 1908. As long as the soul is in continuous attitude of operating good, grace is with her. Now, you know from volume two that grace is an outpouring of God. Jesus said, I am grace. Okay. So this morning, blessed Jesus made himself seen just as a shadow. And he told me, my daughter, as long as the soul is in continuous attitude of working, we would say doing good. Okay. Grace is with her and gives life to all her actions. Now, that's spiritual life. It's divine life. OK, it's not physical life. If then she is indifferent to doing good, she's lazy or she's actually doing evil, grace withdraws. Now, there's two things for that. Habakkuk 1:13. Lord, your eyes are too holy to look upon sin. Habakkuk 1:13. And then the second one is Hebrews 12:14, that you should know off by heart by now. Nothing unholy or unworthy can enter the presence of God. So as soon as sin comes in, grace goes out. It's actually that simple. That's like saying when night comes in, the sun goes out. When morning comes, the night goes and the sun comes out. So you either have one or the other. So if sin comes in, grace goes out. And you see, we need very simple statements like this to keep us really alert to the issues. So if she's in the act of doing evil, now doing evil in these writings is going against the will of God, using your own stubborn will to oppose God. Grace withdraws because it's not something that belongs to it. The evil can't belong to grace. And unable to take part in it or administer its own life, sorrowful, it departs with great displeasure. Therefore, do you want grace to be always with you and my life to form yours? If you do, then remain in the continuous act of doing good. That means in your thoughts, in your words, in your desires, in your actions. We're inclined to think of doing good as sort of running projects, you know what I mean? So it's thoughts, words, actions, everything. Okay? And his desires as well. And you can add in motivations as well there. Okay. So you must remain in the continuous act of doing good. In this way, you will have my whole being developed in you. Therefore, his justice, his mercy, his kindness, his forgiveness, his everything. You will not have to grieve so much if sometimes you do not have my presence. In other words, if you don't actually see me, you'll actually have me. That's like a child has to learn at some point that they must tolerate being in a room while the mother is in another room just for a short time. The child's got to realise that just because I don't see her, it doesn't mean she's not in the house. You know, that's what he's saying here. In fact, he said, you will not see me, but you will touch me with all your actions. Now, there's a wonderful text in 1 Peter 1:8. 1 Peter 1:8. Peter says, though you don't see him, you utterly rejoice because your faith has enabled you to enter fully into the presence. Okay. You will touch me with all your acts. So when we do our acts in the divine will, we're touching the Lord at a very deep level. So whether you see him or not, you're making this contact. And this will soften in part the pain of the privation, he said to her. October the 23rd, 1908. How divine science is in upright operating. Now, we would really need a different title, but never mind. Continuing my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, all of divine science. Now, I don't know whether he's saying knowledge with understanding, because that's usually the word I would put there. Because for us, science means stuff that goes on in a laboratory and the testing and that kind of stuff. Divine science is divine knowledge. Okay. And for someone who is living in union with him, he will infuse divine knowledge into you. So it's contained in upright operating. Operating is working. Okay. Upright means you have the correct intention. And you know that in these writings, the only intention he accepts is that we do something for love of him. In fact, that which is upright or righteous contains everything beautiful and good that can be found. It contains order, usefulness, the word is utility, okay, beauty and mastery. A work is good insofar as it is well ordered. This is fascinating. Because if you look at the beginning of your book, we're on a journey back into the order for which we were created. He's trying to take us out of the disorder of sin and the disorder of selfishness into the divine order where everything can be restored and we can get back to the place where Adam left off. So a work is good insofar as it's well ordered. But if the threads appear crooked and are placed crookedly, one doesn't understand anything. In other words, it's something out of place. If you're listening to music and there's a couple of notes that are not right, you say, ugh, because the disharmony, the order is gone. Is that okay? So if things are not in the right place, you can can't understand anything and you can see nothing but something disorderly, which will be neither useful nor good. This is why, from the greatest to the smallest things that I have made, they all appear orderly. I mean, all the planets, all the stars, everything. And all of them serve a useful purpose, because the fount from which they came was my upright working. Now, as much as a human being is good, so much divine knowledge will she contain within her. Notice, you can only have it in the goodness. It's given to you in the goodness. As much as she is righteous or upright, so many good things will come from her for others. A crooked thread in her working is enough to put herself in disorder as well as the works that come from her, and to obfuscate the divine knowledge that which she contains. One who goes out of what is upright goes out of what is just, holy, beautiful, useful, and goes out of boundaries in which God has placed. And by going out, she will be like a plant that doesn't have much soil under it, or the rays of a scorching sun, or frosts or winds. They'll cause the influence of the divine knowledge to wither within her. Such is crooked operating, like frosts, winds, rays of a scorching sun. So lacking much soil of the divine knowledge, she'll do nothing but disorder. Now, I don't want to go down this road too far, simply because I wouldn't be able to pursue it. The physicists and the astrophysicists, so the ones dealing with the earth and the ones dealing with the sky, all tell you that everything God has made can be reduced to mathematical statements. In other words, they are so orderly that they can predict something simply because of a mathematical statement. If it works in mathematics, it's out there. Otherwise, mathematics wouldn't express it. It's fascinating. We had a discussion there a week or two ago that an awful lot of things for God are either round, which is a perfect structure, or a cube. A cube is also a perfect structure. And of course, if you go and look them up on the internet, you will be told how perfect these signs are. Absolutely incredible. And so everything about them is right. The shape, the size, the usefulness, everything. And you see, when you examine things like that sometimes, you get an insight into God that's fascinating. There is a thing on YouTube about the miracle of mathematics. I wouldn't be able to tell you where it is, because I find these things accidentally. And it tells you, you know, if you add up certain numbers, just exactly how it all works out in the most incredible way. And they ended up, when they just started with one and they kept adding things up to get the same result, they made a perfect pyramid. An absolutely perfect pyramid. You know, that everything in God's universe is just perfect in shape and everything else. So November the 20th, 1908, we're talking about love again. Love is the central topic after divine will, because God is love and the divine will is the operating part of the Trinity. So, continue in my usual state, full of bitterness and of privations. This morning, blessed Jesus came for a little while. I would lament to him about my state, but instead of answering me, he would draw closer to me. And then afterwards, without answering what I was saying, because she loves telling her little story, you know, and he likes getting on with running the universe. Does that give you any reflection about male, female? The detail and the big? Okay. Then afterwards, he said, "My daughter, the true loving soul is not content with loving me with anxiety." This is terribly important. With desires, with surges. But when she comes to make love her food and daily nourishment, only then is she content. In other words, that you don't just get bursts of fervor and then you go off. You know what I mean? That it is consistent day by day by day. It's then that she becomes solid and serious and keeps on losing all that lightness, or we would say frivolity. The frivolity of love is that you get these emotional surges and then they die down. You lose the frivolity of love to which the soul is subject. And since she makes it her food, it's spread throughout all of her members, because what you had for your supper will go to every cell in your body eventually. And because it's spread everywhere, she has the strength to bear the flames of love that consume her and give her life. By containing love within her, by possessing it, she no longer feels those intense desires, those anxieties, but she only feels that she loves more the love that she possesses. In other words, the relationship becomes completely stable. You don't need high peaks and low depths at all. That's sort of early stage stuff. And it becomes very solid, and you just become aware of the fact that you love him more. So this is the love of the blessed in heaven, and it's my own love. Well, his own love in Greek is called agape, A-G-A-P-E, agape. And that was the word that St. John used all the time in his gospel to describe love, whether it was love for God or love for each other. He used agape. And he did that so that he could avoid other words. You see, the problem in English is that we've one word. And so we use the one word love, even if you're talking about lust. Do you know what I mean? So using his word, agape, you know you're talking about divine love. The blessed burn, but without anxiety, without clamour, rather with solidity, with admirable seriousness. This is the sign that a soul has come to feed on love. She loses more and more the characteristics of human love. That's all the emotional traumas and everything. In fact, if one sees only desires, anxieties and surges, it's a sign that love is not her food. That is what keeps you alive on a daily basis. But it's only a few particles of herself that she has dedicated to love. So since she's not all love, underline that one, she does not have the strength to contain it. And so she has those surges of human love. I call them the emotional ups and downs. These, I think you need to add the word unstable souls, are very voluble and without stability in their things, it says here, in their doings, their everyday life. While the former ones are stable like mountains that never move. Now, I've given you the references for love many times. Do you need them again? Nobody said anything. Matthew 22, verses 29 to 30. John 13, 34 to 35. John 15:9. 1 Corinthians 13, verses 1 to 3. And 1 Corinthians 14:1. And Ephesians 3:19 to 21. Ephesians 3:19 to 21. I've given you those references many times. So, December the 16th, 1908. The privation of Jesus is the greatest of all pains. Going through most bitter days, I was lamenting to our Lord, saying, how cruelly you have left me. You told me that you had chosen me as your little daughter and that you would keep me always in your arms. And now you've thrown me to the ground, and instead of a little daughter, I see that you've made me a little martyr. And even though little, my martyrdom is just as cruel and harsh and bitter and intense. Wow, she's able to say it, isn't she? Talk about expressing stuff emotionally. While I was saying this, he moved in my interior, because he's there all the time. And he said, my daughter, you are mistaken. Sometimes he just tells her outright she's wrong. My will is not to make you a little martyr, but to make you a great one. If I give you the strength, that means fortitude. Write the word fortitude over strength. If I give you the fortitude to bear my privation with patience and resignation, which is the most painful and the most bitter thing that can be found, because it's the pain of purgatory. What's the pain of purgatory? You've seen him, you want him desperately, and you can't have him just now. And there is no other pain that equals it or resembles it either in heaven or on earth. Is this not heroism of patience and the ultimate degree in love? Now, you need to put about 10 NBs beside that. Because in all of the terrible pain of the privations, Louisa gave no indication whatsoever that the reason why, well, she suppose she did if you examined it, that the reason why is simply that she loves him and she can't be without him. Now, she does say it over and over again, but you might only hear privation, you mightn't hear what's behind it. He said it's the ultimate degree in love. Now, the person who's saying it is the person who's going to judge her. I wouldn't mind if he said even half of that to me. Okay. Is this not heroism of patience and the ultimate degree in love? Now, of all the mystics that I have read, and I've been studying mystics for 50 years, never come across this, that the Lord ever said that about any of them, including the great Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross and the lot of them. He never said it. He said it about this woman. That's all. That's why I want to point out the uniqueness of Louisa. So it's the ultimate degree of love, compared to which all other loves remain behind, are almost nullified, and there's nothing that can be compared or can stand before it. Is not this then great martyrdom? You say that you're a little martyr because you feel that you do not suffer so much. It's not that you don't suffer, but it is the martyrdom of my privation that absorbs your other pains. In other words, this gets to her so much, she hardly notices the other pains that she has. Isn't that something else? Making them even disappear. Now, in the higher volumes, you'll be told that Jesus will explain that this pain of his privation is actually a divine pain, and that's why it's completely intolerable to her. In fact, in thinking that you are without me, you neither bother about nor pay attention to your other sufferings. But by not paying attention to them, you reach the point of actually not feeling their weight. You know, we say about someone, if they're going through troubles, if you can distract them, it'll actually help. If you can just take their mind off something, it actually helps them. And he's explaining that the pain of his privation has taken her mind off everything else. It's amazing. And therefore you say you don't suffer. And then, I've not thrown you to the ground. Rather, I keep you more than ever clasped in my arms. Even more, I tell you that if to Paul, that's St. Paul, I gave my efficacious grace at the beginning of his conversion, that's Acts chapter 9, the whole chapter. I gave my efficacious grace at the beginning of his conversion, to you I give it almost continually. That's efficacious grace. That's grace that works. And this is the sign of it, that you continue in your interior everything that you used to do when I was with you almost continuously. Doing what now you seem to do by yourself. So I want to give you 1 Peter 1. 1 Peter 1, 8 to 9. You're feeling all immersed in me and bound to me, always thinking of me even though you do not see me. This is not your own thing, nor an ordinary grace. This is special and efficacious grace. And if I give you much, it is a sign that I love you much and that I want to be loved by you. Okay? That, therefore, is a very special section where Jesus explains that for the first time in at that depth. Okay? So, December the 25th, 1908. How to make Jesus be born and grow in hearts. I want to give you John 3:5 before we start. Finding myself in my usual state, I was longing for a little baby Jesus, and after many hardships, he made himself seen in my interior as a little baby. And he told me, my daughter, the best way to make me born in one's own heart is to empty oneself of everything. This is VIP. In other words, it's not difficult to read. It's only difficult to do. Empty oneself of everything, because in finding an empty space, I can place all my goods in it. Now, that empty space is your nothingness. Would you write nothingness over it? Nothingness. And he can do anything with nothingness, because he created the universes out of nothingness. And only then can I claim it forever, he said. If there is room to be able to carry all that belongs to me and all that is my own. So I want to give you Matthew 16, 24. And I want to give you John 3, 30. He must increase and I must decrease. A person who went to live in the house of somebody else could be called happy only if he found empty space in which he would be able to put all his goods. Otherwise, he wouldn't be happy. Isn't that right? Yeah. And he said, I'm the same. Another, my comment there for myself is, we're made like him. Okay. So before the next paragraph, I have a little heading, the only acceptable intention. The second thing in order to make me be born and increase my happiness is that everything the soul contains, both internal and external. Now, everything. Now, he emphasizes the everything. So he's not looking for 90%. He's looking for 100%. Okay? Everything must be done for me. Everything must serve to honor me and to execute my orders. That means let the divine will reign. Okay? So everything must be done for me is the only acceptable intention. Everything must glorify God and let his will be carried out with us. If only one thing, one thought, oh dear, is not for me. That's 2 Corinthians 10, 5. 2 Corinthians 10, 5. Every thought must be captured and given to Christ. Okay. So if even one thought or one word is not for me, I feel unhappy. And while I should be the master, they make me the slave. How can I tolerate all this? So for honor there, we have to honor him. Do you see the little bit of the honor? You see it? I want to give you 1 Samuel 2:30. Those who honor me, I will honor, says the Lord. 1 Samuel 2:30. S-A-M for Samuel. 2:30. So the heading for the next paragraph is sacrificial love. The third one is heroic love, magnified love, love of sacrifice. So notice the love of sacrifice is called heroic and magnified, or love that is really grown. These three loves make my happiness grow in a marvellous way, because they render the soul capable of works which are superior to her strength. Now, superior to her physical strength, therefore they come from fortitude. As she does them with my strength alone. So the human strength can't do it, fortitude can. Okay, put John 15:5 there as well. Without me, you can do nothing. And Philippians 4:13, you know these ones off by heart, don't you? I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength.
Philippians
4:13. So you do them in my strength alone. They will expand her. That means the soul, its capacity expands. By making not only her, but also others love me. And she will reach the point of enduring anything, even death, in order to triumph in everything and be able to say to me, I have nothing else. Everything is only love for you. That would be a fantastic moment, wouldn't it? In this way, she will not only make me be born, but will make me grow and will form a beautiful paradise for me in her heart. As he was saying this, I looked at him, and from little, in one instant, he became big in such a way that I remained completely filled with him, and then everything disappeared. So, December 27, 1908. If you want a heading for this, this is the one, an absolutely fantastic teaching on the I love you. I was meditating on when the Blessed Mother would give her milk to the baby Jesus. I was saying to myself, what must have passed between the Most Holy Mother and the little Jesus in this act? In that moment, I felt a move in my interior, and I heard him say to me, my daughter, when I suckled milk from the breast of my most sweet mother, together with milk, I suckled the love of her heart. Now, in this is volume 8. When you go back to volume 2 and 3, and she's Louise is beginning to describe some intimate experiences she had with the Lord. She's talking about suckling from him, or he's suckling from her. And then she eventually says, oh no, he's actually taking it from my heart. And she's saying that here as well. Jesus said to her that he suckled the love of his mother's heart. And it was more love than milk that I suckled. So while suckling, I would hear her say to me, I love you, my son. And I would repeat to her, I love you, my mother. And I was not alone in this. At my I love you, the Father and the Holy Spirit and the whole of creation, the angels, the saints, the stars, the sun, the drops of water, the plants, the flowers, the grains of sand, all the elements would run after my I love you and repeat, we love you, O Mother of our God, in the love of our Creator. Isn't that fantastic? My mother could see all this. Look at that. Why? Because she's living in the divine will fully and would have remained inundated. She could find not even a tiny space in which she would not hear me say that I loved her. Her love would remain behind and almost alone, and she would repeat, I love you, I love you. Now, this goes on between Louisa and himself as well. But she could never match me. Why? Because she's a creature and he's the creator. Because the love of a creature has its limits and its time, while mine is uncreated, unending and eternal. That's Jeremiah 31, 3. Jeremiah 31, 3. Ephesians 3:19. So the same happens to any soul when she says to me, I love you. I too repeat to her, I love you. And with me is the whole of creation loving her in my love. That's Romans 8:19. Romans 8:19. Oh, if souls understood what good and honour they procure for themselves, even by just saying to me, I love you, this alone would be enough to have God beside them, who honouring them replies, I love you too. That's your 1 Samuel 2:30 again. Those who honour me, I will honour. Okay, so December the 28th, 1908, we have earthquakes in Sicily and Calabria. That's in Italy. So I want to give you Isaiah 46:10. 46:10 and Amos 3:7. The Lord never does anything without telling the prophets first. Amos 3:7. Finding myself in my usual state, I felt as if the earth were shaking and wanted to slip away from beneath us. I was concerned and I said to myself, Lord, Lord, what's this? And he said, earthquakes. Now, what I think is funny about this and why I'm laughing is she's in bed. She can't go anywhere. She feels the earth shaking under her. She actually feels the earthquake. And she says, Lord, what is this? And he just says, earthquakes. You know, as if it was nothing. And then he remains silent. I almost paid no attention to him, and within myself I continued my interior things, when all of a sudden, about 5 hours after the word had been spoken, I felt the earthquake sensibly. As soon as I felt it cease, I found myself outside of myself, almost confused. I could see harrowing things, but this sight was immediately removed from me, and I found myself inside of a church. He doesn't want her to get upset, you see, because he has done this without telling her, you see. So a young man clothed in white came from the altar. I believe it was our Lord, but I can't say with certain. And then he said, come. I shrugged my shoulders, Louisa said, without getting up. Wonderful, isn't it? And calculating within me that at that hour he was scourging and destroying, I said, Lord, what do you want me for now? Almost refusing his invitation, and the young man threw himself into my arms, and in my interior I heard him say, come, O daughter, that I may end it with the world. I will destroy a great part of it with earthquakes, waters, that's tsunamis, and wars. After this, I found myself inside of myself. Well, that's a scary bit, isn't it? So December the 30th, the infancy of Jesus divinizes the infancy of all. This is the redoing of human nature. Okay, so just put redoing there.
Redoing
human nature. I was meditating on the mystery of Jesus' infancy, and I said to myself, my baby, to how many pains you wanted to subject yourself, it was not enough for you to... Was it not enough for you to come as an adult? You wanted to come as a baby, and you suffer from swaddling clothes, silence, the immobility of your little humanity, of your feet and your hands. Why all this? While I was saying this, he moved in my interior and he told me, my daughter, my works are perfect. I wanted to come as a little infant in order to divinize all the sacrifices and all the little actions of infancy. There's the redoing of human beings. So until, this is wonderful what he says here, until children begin to commit sins, everything remains absorbed in my childhood and divinized by me. Now, next time you look at an infant, just realize that all their actions are divinized in him. Isn't that absolutely incredible? When sin then begins, separation begins between me and that person, a separation which is sorrowful for me and mournful for them. And Louisa said, how can this be if babies don't have reason and are not capable of deserving? And he answered, first, because I give merit by my grace. Very important information for aborted babies you've sent on to God, isn't it? Secondly, because it's not out of their will that they do not want to deserve, but because such is the state of infancy, which is disposed by me anyway. So it's God's will. Besides, a gardener who has planted a plant is not only honoured, but he also picks the fruit of it. And even though the plant does not have reason. And this is the same for the artisan who makes a statue and for many other things. Sin alone, this is the gem now you need to colour. Sin alone is that which destroys everything and separates the human being from me. But everything else, even the most trivial action, comes to the souls from me, and to me it returns with the mark of the honour of my creation. Isn't that fantastic? I want to give you several scriptures there. Proverbs 14, 34. Proverbs 14, 34. Isaiah 50, verses 16 to 22. Isaiah 59, verse 2. So now we go on to January the 2nd, 1909. And again, Jesus tells her about earthquakes and stuff. So that's your Isaiah 46, 10. To my great repugnance and only to obey, I continue to say what happened from December the 28th regarding the earthquake. Because you remember she said she actually felt it.
Yeah.
I was thinking to myself about the lot of so many poor people alive under the rocks, and about the lot of my Lord in the sacrament. Now, you see, in 1909, they wouldn't have had the same ability to lift people from under rocks as they do now. And also about the lot of my Lord in the sacrament, he too alive and buried under the rubble. So obviously churches were destroyed. I said to myself, it seems as if the Lord is saying to these people, I have the same lot as you because of your sins. I am together with you to help you, to give you strength. I love you so much that I am waiting for one last act of love to save you all. Not taking into account all the evil that you've done in the past. Ah, my good, my life and my all, I send you my adorations under the rubble wherever you are, and my embraces and kisses and with all my powers to keep you continuous company. Oh, how I wish I could come and dig you out to put you in a more comfortable place and more worthy of you. Now, the answer she gets back from him is a terrible shock for her. At that moment, my adorable Jesus told me in my interior, my daughter, you have somehow interpreted the excesses of my love. Notice the somehow, not completely. Which, even while scourging, I send to the people. In other words, God's love never ceases. But this isn't all, there's more. Know that my sacramental lot is perhaps less unhappy, less nauseating under the rocks than in the tabernacles. Isn't that a bit frightening? Mm-hmm. The number of sacrileges committed by priests and also by the people is such that I'm tired of descending into their hands and into their hearts to the point of being forced to destroy almost all of them. Oh dear. I want to give you a Revelation 11:18, I think it is. I will destroy the destroyers of the earth. 11:18.
Thank you.
And then, what about the ambition and the scandals of priests? God, this was not only 1909. Mm. This is more than a century later. Everything was darkness in them, he said. They were no longer the light of the world that they were supposed to be. That's Matthew 5:17. You're the light of the world. Matthew 5:17. And when priests reach the point of no longer giving out light, the people reach the excesses, that is, of evil. And my justice is forced to destroy them. We're seeing that today, aren't we? So that's why there's no way out of chastisement. I was also thinking about his privations, Louisa said, and I felt a fear in me. As if some strong earthquake was about to happen here. That's in Karata. In seeing myself so alone without Jesus, I felt so oppressed as to feel I was dying. Then having compassion for me, good Jesus came like a shadow. And he told me, my daughter, do not oppress yourself so much. Out of regard for you, I will spare this city most grave damages. Isn't that incredible? Yeah. So I want to give you Isaiah 49:16. One who stands in the breach. If I should not continue to chastise, instead of converting, of surrendering, that is surrendering to the divine will, in hearing of the destruction of other provinces, they say that it is those places and lands that make this happen, and they take their own good time continuing to offend me. Okay. You'll find that also referenced in, I think it's Revelation 16, but I don't remember exactly what the verse is. And what it says in Revelation 16 is that for the people who didn't experience the chastisements, they continued on with all their evil. How blind and foolish they are. It is the whole earth. Is the whole earth not in the palm of my hand? Okay, that's Song of Songs 2:16. We're in the palm of his hand. Could I perhaps not open chasms in the earth and cause them to be swallowed up in other places as well? Now, I would just say CF Exodus. Because you remember Dathan and Abiram in Exodus, the earth opened up and swallowed them up for their rebellion against God. And to show them this, I will cause earthquakes in other places which they usually do not occur. Now, there's also a reference in Isaiah for that I will have to show you signs that you won't be able to say, we've seen all this before. You know. So while saying this, he seemed to stretch out his hand into the center of the earth, taking some fire and moving it closer to the surface of the earth. And the earth would shake and the earthquake would be felt, some places more intensely and other places less. And he added, this is only the beginning of chastisements. What will be the end of them? Well, you go to the book of Revelation for that, and there's three huge movements of chastisements from chapter 8, 9 and 10, and chapter 16, the three movements. So January the 8th, 1909, the fruit and the purpose of Holy Communion. Having received communion at the best moment, I was thinking of how I could cling to Blessed Jesus more than ever. And he said to me, in order to cling more tightly, to the point of dissolving your being in mine, that's John 14, 20 to 21. And St. Paul also says, for me to live is Christ. Just as I transfuse mine into yours, you must take what is mine in everything. And in everything, leave what is yours. You see, we're not allowed any baggage. That's the problem. And we have no idea how much baggage we have until we start shifting some of it. Have you ever tried clearing out your house and you thought you were doing really well and you said, God, there's a few more rooms as well? And the more you do one place, the more there is to be done. That's the awful thing about doing something in your house. So it's the same spiritually as well. You know, you're really making an effort and then you realise, God, there's more and more and more and more. He wants everything to go. Okay. We're not allowed any baggage. So you have to leave what is yours in such a way that if you always think of things which are holy and regard only what is good and the honour and glory of God, you leave your mind and take the divine. In other words, you stop your human machinations in your thinking and you take on a divine way of thinking. When you stop loving in a human way, you take on a divine way of loving. When you stop just a human way of being, you take on a divine way of being. If you speak, if you operate good and only out of love for God, you leave your mouth and your hands and you take my mouth and you take my hands. That's where the healing hands comes from. If you walk along holy and upright paths, you will walk with my own feet. If your heart loves me more, you will leave your heart and you will take mine. And you will love me with my own love. It's the only love that's useful to him because it's divine. And so with all the rest. So you will be enveloped with all of my things and I with all of yours. We give him what we can't keep in order to receive what we can't lose. It's fantastic, isn't it? Yeah. We give him what we can't keep in order to receive from him what we can't lose. So Jesus said, can there be a tighter union than this? And I with, yeah. If the soul reaches the point of no longer recognizing herself, but the divine being within her, these are the fruits of good communions. Wow, you're supposed to be sanctified with them. Galatians 2:20. Now, St. Therese of Lisieux said that she was aware of growing in holiness every time she received communion. I find that astonishing, do you? Yeah. And this is the divine purpose in wanting to communicate himself to souls. In other words, to transform us into himself and to divinize us. But how frustrated my love remains, and how few are the fruits that souls gather from this sacrament, to the point, look at this, that the majority of them remains indifferent and even nauseated by this divine food. Isn't that incredible? So I want to give you Numbers 21:5. It says we are sick of this unsatisfying food. Okay. So January 22nd, 1909, when God is the debtor of the soul. I was thinking about the many privations of our Lord and about the fact that once years ago, after I had waited for our Lord for a few hours, when he came, I lamented to him for he had made me struggle so much for his coming. And then he told me, my daughter, when I surprise you, anticipating your yearnings for me, and I come without having you wait, then you're in my debt. You're my debtor. But when I have you wait for some time and I come, I become your debtor. Oh, Louise is not going to let him off with this ever. She's going to remind him. This is ammunition that he's given her. Because she'll tell him, you're in my debt. You've got to pay your debt. And do you think it's trivial to have that God gives you the occasion to make him your debtor? You see, people at our level wouldn't know why the fuss was being made. But at her level, it's huge. Okay. And Louisa said, I was saying to myself, at that time it was hours and now it's days. Who knows how many debts he has made with me? I believe they are innumerable, because he has been having many of these whims. Look at the way she's talking about him. He's real to her, isn't he? But then I thought to myself, and what's the good of me having God as a debtor? I believe to have him as a debtor or to be his debtor is the same for Jesus, because in one instant he can give so much to the soul as to equal and surpass the debts he has. And so here's how the debts are cancelled. So she's sort of writing it off. Mm-hmm. Okay. But while I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, you're speaking nonsense. In addition to the spontaneous gifts that I give to souls, there are, number two, gifts of bond. This is a new language. To the souls of the spontaneous gifts, I may give or may not. It's my choice, because no bond binds me. But with the souls, with the gifts of bond, as in your case, I am bound and forced to give them what they want and to grant them my gifts. Imagine a gentleman and two persons. One of these two keeps his money in his hands, in the hands of the gentleman, while the other doesn't. The gentleman may give to both one and the other, but which one is more sure to obtain in a circumstance of need, the one who has the money in the hands of the gentleman or the one who doesn't? Certainly the one who has the money will have all the good dispositions, the courage, the confidence to go and ask for what is deposited in the hands of that gentleman. And if he sees him hesitant in giving, he will say to him frankly, you better give it to me and quickly, because indeed I'm not asking you for what is yours but what is mine. On the other hand, if the other one goes, who has nothing deposited in the hands of the gentleman, he will go timidly and without confidence, and it'll be up to the gentleman whether he wants to give him some help or not. This is the difference that passes between when I am the debtor and when I'm not. If you could understand what immense goods are produced by having a credit with me. He's trying to get her to somehow grasp what he's saying, but initially she wasn't. So Louisa said, I add that while I was writing, I was thinking to myself, oh, some more nonsense. When I am in heaven, my dear Jesus, you will feel irritated for having made so many debts with me. While if you come now, since I become your debtor, you who are so good, at the first encounter we will have, will cancel all the debts. In other words, she says, if you're full of debts, why don't you just come now? And you can pay them all. That's not a problem to me. The problem is when you stay away. Um, But I, who am bad, will not let it go, and will demand payment for even a breath of waiting. Wow. This is eight volumes later, isn't it? That's a lot of debt, isn't it, for every breath? But while I was thinking of this, he told me in my interior, my daughter, I will not feel irritation but contentment because my debts are debts of love. That's Romans 13, verses 1 to 2. Romans 13, let all your debts be debts of love, Paul says. And I desire to be the debtor more than to have you as my debtor. In fact, these debts which I make with you, while being debts for me, will be pledges and treasures which I will keep in my heart for eternity and which will give you the right to be loved by me more than others. This will be one more joy and glory for me, and you will be repaid for even a breath, a minute, a desire, a heartbeat, and the more pressing and greedy you will be in demanding, the more pleasure you will give me and the more I will give you. Do you remember he promised for any of us who would follow him that you'd get the 100%? Do you remember? The 100% in houses. I don't know how that works. And in everything else that you gave up for him. So he says, are you happy now? Okay, so January the 27th, 1909. Continuing in my usual state, I said to myself, what a useless life mine is. After all of this, she comes around to what a useless life this is. What good do I do? Everything's over. There's no more sharing of thorns, crosses and nails. It seems that everything is exhausted. I do feel suffering to the point that I cannot move. It is a general rheumatism of pain, she says. But it's something all natural. Now, he has explained it two passages back. All of this, explained it all in great detail, and she's back to where she was. That doesn't happen to you, does it? Yeah. It takes human beings a lot before they can actually grasp something new that's said to them. And I'm sure you've said to people, and particularly children or anyone that you are trying to train, but I told you that 10 times already. Yeah. I mean, how many more ways do I have to say it before you hear it? Because that's the way we are. And that's why we have to keep studying this stuff, because if you take it all in one reading, congratulations. Okay. Louisa is not really aware that he is gradually turning her to a new vocation. This is volume 8, you see, and by volume 11, she's in her new vocation, which is to start the kingdom of the divine will. And so she doesn't have to continue being the victim soul once she's really into it. And so she's in this interim phase and she doesn't understand. I'm only left with the continuous thought of the passion, she said, and the union of my will with that of Jesus, offering what he suffered and all of myself as he wants for whoever he wants. But apart from this, there's nothing but squalid misery. Very interesting description of her life, isn't it? There was the purpose of my life. While I was thinking of this, blessed Jesus came. He has to come when she goes into this kind of nonsense. And he says, my daughter, do you know who you are? Louisa of the Passion of the Tabernacle. Isn't that? He gives her this title. Okay. When I share my pains with you, you are still of Calvary. When I don't, you are of the Tabernacle. See how true this is. In the tabernacle, I show nothing on the outside, neither crosses nor thorns, and yet my immolation is the same as on Calvary. The prayers are the same. The offering of my life still continues. My will has not changed in any way. I burn with thirst for the salvation of souls. I can say that the things of my sacramental life united with those of my mortal life are always at one point. They have decreased in nothing. However, everything is interior. This is the way he's trying to say to her. He's gearing her now to a completely interior life. We'll have none of the externals. So if your will is the same as when I used to share my pains, notice I used to share my pains. She's in the transition time. If your offerings are similar, if your interior is united with me, with my will, am I not right in saying that you are Louisa of the Passion of the Tabernacle, with this difference, that when I share my pains with you, you take part in my mortal life, that is, ad extra, and I spare the world the gravest scourges. When I do not share them with you, I scourge the world, and you take part in my sacramental life, but the life is always one. Isn't that interesting? So January the 28th, 1909, he's talking about victim souls. Having read a book that talked about the different ways of operating interiorly, he's been talking about interior life, so she reads a book about it, and about how Jesus would compensate these souls with the great capital of grace and with superabundant love, which he has already told her anyway. I compared everything I had read to the many ways and the different acts that Jesus has taught me in my interior, which compared to those in the book seemed to me to be so vast as the sea compared to a little river. And I said to myself, if this is true, who knows how much grace my always lovable Jesus pours into me and how much love he has for me. Then, as I found myself in my usual state, good Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, you do not yet know well what it means to be chosen as a victim soul. Just as I, by being a victim soul, enclosed in myself all the acts of creatures, their satisfactions, reparations, adorations and thanksgivings, in such a way that I did for all and for each one that which they were supposed to do. In the same way, since you are a victim soul, it is useless to compare yourself to others, because he's been telling her for 8 volumes that she's to be a copy of him. Mm-hmm. She's not to look at other people. You must enclose within you not the way of one, but the variety of the ways of each one. And since I must have you make up for all and for each one as a consequence, I must give you not the grace that I give to one person, but as much grace to equal what I give to the whole of humanity. That's unbelievable, isn't it? Therefore, love too must surpass all the love that I give to everybody else, because grace and love go together. That's 1 John 4:7-21. 1 John 4:7-21. Grace and love must go together. They have one single step, one single measure, and one single will. Love draws grace and grace draws love. They're inseparable because grace and love are both God. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. So this is why you see the most extensive sea which I have placed in you and the little rivers in others. So Louisa said, I remained astounded comparing much grace to so much ingratitude and badness in me. Okay, so we're coming to the end of this particular section. And we finish with January the 30th, 1909. And the amazing thing is, it's called The Story of Why. Okay. You'll be very surprised what he says about why. Because my memory of childhood is the child saying, why? You know, no matter what the adult says, the child says why, because they're in the process of learning. But an adult saying it is different. Why does the good God do that to me? And we close the fist. That why is a problem. The why of the infant, the small child who's in a learning process about everything, their why is completely different. Okay, so it's our adult why is the problem. Finding myself in my usual state, I found myself outside of myself and I seemed to see a soul in purgatory whom I knew. And I said to her, take a look at how I am before God. I find this fascinating. If you saw a soul in purgatory, surely your first thing is to go and pray for the poor creature. And instead of that, Louisa said, no, I want you to do a discernment on me. Isn't it fascinating?
Yeah.
Take a look at how I am before God, she said. I'm so concerned about it, especially about the state in which I find myself. And the soul told me, it takes nothing to know whether you're doing well or badly. If you appreciate suffering, you're doing well. If you don't, you're doing badly. That's a soul in purgatory who have learned that suffering is the way to get to heaven. Isn't that fascinating? God, nobody on earth would say that, would they? In fact, one who appreciates suffering appreciates God, because suffering has become the way to purify and cleanse us. And by appreciating him, you can't displease him. Things which are appreciated are also esteemed and loved, and one cherishes them and keeps them safe more than oneself. Can it ever be possible that one wants evil for himself? In the same way, it's impossible that one may displease God if he appreciates him. Then afterwards, Blessed Jesus came for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, in almost all of the events that occur, people keep repeating over and over again, why this illness, why this interior state, why this scourge, so many whys. The explanation of why is not written on earth, but in heaven. And it's there, everyone will read it. Do you know what why is? It is egoism, he said, which gives continuous food to the love of self. Do you know where why was created? In hell. Who was the first to pronounce it? A demon. The effects produced by the first why were the loss of innocence in Eden itself, and the war of untamed passions, the ruin of many souls, the evils of life. The story of why is long. It is enough to tell you that there's no evil in the world which does not carry the mark of why. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Why is the destruction of divine wisdom in souls? Now, you see, under why there, he's actually covering in a very, very simple way this whole problem of rationalism mm-hmm. and humanism and all the rest of it that destroys a godly way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So that's why he says that why is the destruction of divine wisdom in souls. And do you know where why will be buried? In hell. To make them restless for eternity without ever giving them any peace. The art of why is to wage war against souls without ever giving them respite. Is that something else? So I want to leave it there. And that's the end of volume 8.